Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. Let me tell you, this was one of the most interesting shows for me to prepare for. We are going to go over what the three, I would call one, absolutely one of the most prolific FBI agent profilers that is still alive, what he has to say about the Nancy Guthrie case. What another woman, never an FBI agent, but certainly a consultant, and kind of brought in sort of the medical and psychological abstract into profiling. And then finally, what the last one, he is a professor, PhD educator, never worked with the FBI, never worked as an FBI agent, but from the academic standpoint and from studying cases, what he has to say. Those are the three most, what I would call, the people that I really, really value and wanted to hear what they had to say. And so anyway, we're going to talk about it because it's very interesting. It's also, I think, really important to understand the background of each of these individuals. I think that's really critically important because then you can decide what weight to give. Also, by some of the things they say, you can decide what weight to give in terms of what they know about the facts of the case. Because at the end of the day, what profilers look at are the facts. You have to look at the facts known for them to then sort of glean what you can take from known facts and glean into behavior you've seen profiled and so on in the past. So we're going to break it all down. I like I said, this was one of the most interesting shows I've ever prepared for. Perhaps because I know two of these individuals extremely well. One of them is a mentor of mine. Another of them has become a good friend over the years. Let me, first of all, I want to talk about what Ann Burgess has to say. And again, we're discussing Nancy Guthrie. I always think it's interesting to me when you look at this case, and so many are still saying it's cold, it's cold, it's cold. Even for me, somebody who is looking at this case through the lens of an advocator, somebody who is trying to put forth information to keep this obviously at the forefront, not wanting this case to go cold, wanting to educate as best I can in terms of everything I find on a case, also to just bring forward information that people might not know because they don't have time to do these crazy deep dives that we are doing every day on a daily basis on these cases. There's not a day that goes by that I'm not deep diving what is going on with Nancy Guthrie, what are people saying. Now, unfortunately, and I don't get down these crazy rabbit holes, but there's so many rabbit holes out there. You know, I've said it before. I always caution people, look at the creator who's bringing you the information. Look at what they're really saying. Look at whether they are backstopping it, meaning do they have the proof that stands behind something they say or something they put forward. That's another big thing because all of you in audience, and that's why I love this true crime community. I love the X community. You're not just going to listen and move forward with what's being said. You want meat on the bone. And that's what we do here. We're going to discuss cases from a factual vantage. We're not a drama channel. A lot of people want the drama. And there's plenty of channels out there that will provide that for those who might be more interested in what I call the guiding light slash, you know, what was that other one? The guiding light, General Hospital, you know, what has taken the place of those soap operas has become true crime. And so a lot of people love the conspiracy theories. They love anything that is negative toward somebody. They love to tear people down. It's crazy as I do my scrubs, I call them, every day on this case. And then I'll, you know, oh, something came up with Nancy Guthrie. Let me take a look over here. And I get about 3 minutes in and I'm just shaking my head and run away. But still, I always like to know what's going on with the conspiracy theorists. I like to know what's going on with people who are still indicting, if you will, on social media anyway, the family. I like to see where they're coming from. And I want to know if there's any proof. I want to give you an example of that. So recently here on this, on our channel, I saw somebody came forward and I want to tell you, we just have the most amazing mods, right? So they're very good at sending, backdooring me and letting me know, hey, you might want to take a look at this. Hey, this individual said this. This is truly a team effort with our mods and with, our fact-finding crew in the back. We have a whole group of people that I will ask if they can look into this or that. And I, what I'm looking for is give me the fact basis. Show me the book that says this. Show me the interview where they said this. Show me a legal document where this was said. So when I come on and talk to you all, I know I have the facts behind me. But one of them was in regard to Tommaso and Annie. And specifically, they said that Tommaso and Annie had not paid their taxes on their home. First of all, I was shocked at something I just got to tell you, because they live in about a $600,000-$700,000 home. And I was shocked when I saw how much their taxes were. Their taxes are about $4,000 a year. $4,000 a year. Now, if you have ever lived in Florida, or if you've ever lived in Texas, and of course, it's largely because we do not have state income tax in either of those states, the states where I, you know, go back and forth between. It is shocking how low these taxes are. People who live in Texas and in Florida, you're paying an incredible amount. If you own $1 million home, you're paying at least minimum 10, 15 grand on that. If you own a $2 million home, you're paying upwards to $40, $50,000 a year. It's the Texas and the Florida taxes, same in Florida. It is absolutely unbelievable. And why it's really crazy is if you are in the instance of like Nancy Guthrie. Nancy Guthrie lived in this house since the 70s, everyone. She had this house for about 50 years. So while she bought it for $89,000, she bought the house for $89,000. And of course, now if you look, it's worth somewhere between $900,000 and about $1 million. Which, of course, I think whenever it comes to be sold, that will greatly be reduced because, you know, people will know, unfortunately, that the terrible circumstances that happened in that house, right? And so, nevertheless, you can see what this means to homeowners like Nancy. It's so unfair. So if you originally bought a house for $89,000 50 years ago, and now your house is worth $1 million, you're going to be taxed at the current rate. Yes, you get to homestead, so you get a little bit off of it, and they can only raise it by about 3% each year. But nevertheless, you are absolutely taxed on the value of that home now, not from 1970s. So this is why it's, you know, extremely difficult, and why a lot of people, for instance, in Florida, and I'm not trying to wane too much about what our show is about today, but why people, for instance, in Florida, the governor of Florida is moving to make taxes on homeowners that we don't have to pay any homeowners taxes. What he wants to do is he wants to take that from sales. In other words, you buy a boat, it's going to be increased by a couple percentage points, no matter what you buy, a gallon of milk, shoes, a boat, you're going to have to pay increased by, I think, 1 to 2%, he said, to make up for homeowners taxes. Of course, everybody wants that. And he's doing it because he sees how unfair it is to somebody who purchased a home when they were younger, and then now they're in their 80s and they're having to pay ridiculous amounts. Now in Arizona, I have just come to find out, the taxes are really, really, really low. So, you know, that's a good thing. But essentially, how they do it in Arizona is you can pay in two parts. So you can pay initially at one deadline half, and then at the other deadline, the other half. So in October of 2025, Annie Guthrie and Tommaso Cioni paid the first half, which was around $2,000, a little bit over $2,000. They paid that first half. And then the second half was due in March 1st. From my research, it seems they did not pay the second $2,000-ish. It was due May 1st is kind of their final cutoff where it's considered delinquent. So I'll have to go back and look, because March 1st was yesterday. I'm sorry, May 1st. May 1st was yesterday. If you're late past March 1st, there are penalties you have to pay, but you're not considered fully delinquent until May 1st, at least from my research. So, but a lot of people were trying to say, see, they didn't pay their taxes. Well, they didn't tell everybody. In other words, every day I'm trying to find out, why does everybody think that Tommaso and Annie are so guilty? I wish I had a picture of them up here in my library. I don't have a picture of them up here in my library today. But nevertheless, I just wanted to touch on this point. And it comes into play when we're looking at what these different profilers have said about the Nancy Guthrie case. So I just wanted to touch on, for those that continue to blame Annie and Tommaso, and they're saying that, see, they needed the money as if they have some huge tax debt. It appears to me that it was $2,000. And I also want to say that if there was an extension that was asked for beyond, we know that it was paid, the first half was paid in October of 2025. If there was an extension that was asked for, that likely would not be public record. I don't see any extensions like that publicly. What we can see is when taxes are paid and how much is paid and how much is due, and we can see certain general deadlines. So no one really knows. But I can tell you, we are not talking about some huge astronomical debt. And I just thought it was unfair, as I was reviewing and scrubbing a little bit this morning, that people were trying to make this point, and somebody, you know, legitimately, people are asking, well, is it true? In other words, are they in money debt, and somehow knocking off Nancy caused them to be out of money debt? I don't want to get down that rabbit trail, because today is Profiler Day, but I just wanted to remark that when you say something in chat, a lot of that is circled back to me, especially legitimate concerns, claims, things you want answered. And so we look into that. So I appreciate all your questions. I appreciate when you have a different opinion. It's all good, to, in my opinion, to have different opinions. Whenever I was in leadership roles, both at the FBI and over well, it's always been the FBI because that's my whole background, but at the FBI in different capacities, right? Whether I was a supervisor, whether I was an SSRA, whether I was an SRA, or whether I was a case agent and I had a crew. So my largest crew ever was 10 agents assigning me as the case agent. The supervisor doesn't want anything to do with all of that. That they delegate that down and you're assigned to how you individually task each of those 10 people on your crew. So no matter what leadership responsibility I had in the FBI, in each of those cases, you look at what needs to be done and you want to fulfill the concerns. And that's how I still think of it here. Whether it's on YouTube or whether it's on Twitter, you know, I don't know. I don't get paid. I shouldn't say that because YouTube, obviously, because of you all having more subscribers and everything. I remember I joked around and it wasn't a joke, but I joked with my husband about this, that for all the time I spent, I made, and I just bring this up, not for you to feel sorry for me, but just how funny it really is, about $16 an episode, which is so funny. Now, of course, because of you all and because I'm able to set a set time and really try to come on at 10 a.m. every morning, we have become so much more successful. And I thank each of you. And what that has meant for me is I can certainly have more people come help and more people I think are interested in helping. We have the best mods. We always have had. They are amazing. And I think part of the reason that they are so amazing is they see it as part of a team and wanting to build something successful and something that's worthwhile. So now that I've completely digressed, let's get on to, and this is so funny, I'll look at the comments later and I'll see where she says she starts talking about Nancy at this time frame. So we're ready to get into it. So here we go. I want to first talk about Anne Burgess. And we can't talk about Anne Burgess without truly understanding what Anne Burgess did for and with the FBI and what she's all about. So let's talk about her first, okay? So Anne Burgess, I want to make it clear, was never an FBI agent. She never served as an FBI agent. She never... I don't know if she ever tried to be an FBI agent. I wouldn't have doubted that she might have wanted to do that. But her background was actually in nursing. But specifically, what they call a forensic nurse and professor. So her education was as a nurse. And obviously, she was also a professor. But what she was, and this, a lot of people don't know this, but in the Bureau, there are professionals that are completely private that help the Bureau. And that's what I've been saying. I am certain is going on right now with the investigation concerning both the cryptocurrency, aka Bitcoin, and also the emails. There's 6 emails that were sent from the abductor or abductors of Nancy Guthrie that the Bureau is trying to trace. Yes, do we have some of the best in the FBI? Yes, we do in terms of forensic gathering of digital evidence and being able to understand how not only money, but how emails are tracked and so forth. I've discussed over and over again that what the roadblocks are likely. I say that they're likely based on the fact that we have no results after 90 days, it would seem, that point to a suspect being arrested. Well, we know that, right? Nobody's been charged. Nobody's been arrested. It remains unsolved. And part of the reasons that these emails cannot be traced is because emails can be, you can use VPNs. We all know about those. I have a VPN. I'm sure many of you have VPNs. And that reduces the ability to trace back the IP address. Number two, you can have email addresses that are from foreign entities. In other words, they're German, Swedish, particularly, they're Swiss. And when you have that, it makes it very difficult for law enforcement to get that information from a foreign entity. And most of those countries put privacy of their citizenry well above what we do. In other words, we lean a little bit toward, listen, we can invade people's privacy when it comes to criminal activity. If you're involved in criminal activity, we can overhear your phones. We can get subpoenas to look at, you know, the DNA you've submitted to 23andMe when you're talking about a quadruple homicide, things like that. Whereas in other countries, in a lot of ways, everyone, that is guarded. It's really heavily guarded. And if they stop doing that, they would really lose the conviction of their citizenry, because that's the kind of country they want to live in. Remember during the Holocaust, when everything was taken from the Jewish people, much of that went to Swiss banks, and it was kept very secretive. And that was a big deal. So this is not something new. It's something very well known. And so nevertheless, there are all these safeguards. The other thing is public Wi-Fi. You can do so much on public Wi-Fi, it will never go back to you. It'll go back to Starbucks. And then somebody has to try to figure out who was at Starbucks at that time that might have used it. But again, I've talked about the other two layers, like the VPN, as well as the foreign emails. So I think you are talking about literally something that sophisticated for the FBI to not have already cracked, who sent six emails to three different news stations. I've talked about that they went to two Tucson local stations, another reason why many of us that have been following this case highly believe that this case is well related to somebody in and around this area. And this was to humiliate this family that has a huge footprint in Tucson. Everyone, I just looked up and I'm getting it flashed that my computer is going dead. I had a hit early this morning on News Nation, and then a lot last night. And so I didn't track very well that my computer is about dead. Let me get this hooked up before we end up with this going down really quick. And yes, you're going to see I have on bottoms that do not match. Let's see here. I can grab, hopefully. Stand by, everyone. Be right back. Hopefully you forgive me, everyone. I apologize for that. That's a first to have happened. I am going to actually move closer to a power cord, power outlet, I should say. All right, everyone. Again, I apologize. And I appreciate you all bearing with me for that. I just didn't want everything to go down and then we would be in trouble. But nevertheless, when you look at the technology involved with this group, it makes, or group or person, it makes it quite clear that we are talking about a lot of sophistication. And when you look at the profilers and their evaluation, they are absolutely looking into all of these situations for them to help understand the profile of the people involved. And by the way, I see these comments down here and they are so nice. Thank you so much again for understanding this issue that came up with the electricity. I will, on the YouTube, I can go back and cut this out. I've never had that happen, but I did learn how to do cuts. I never do it, but I'm going to learn. I learned how to, and I will be doing it. You guys are the best. But I want to talk about what Anne Burgess had to say. And like I said, it's critical we understand who she was. She was a nurse. She, as I mentioned, the Bureau, when there's something they can't solve, they go to other professionals. They get the best of the best, what we call industry specialists, SMEAC subject matter experts. I'm sorry, SMEs subject matter experts. That have worked in the industry forever. You can imagine all of those out there, specifically in the cyber world. So Anne Burgess, they went to her. She was, again, a forensic nurse, never an FBI agent. And she helped consult in the behavioral science unit. It was called that then. Now it's called the behavioral analysis unit. And she began helping. Now, who did she help? Who was she involved with? There were three major original profilers, everyone: John Douglas, Greg McCrary, and Ressler. Those were the three originals. Mindhunter, for instance, the Netflix movie, she never consulted on that movie at all. But if you look at who consulted with Mindhunters, it was John Douglas and Greg McCrary. They were partners. Greg, I've shared with you before, is one of my mentors. We work at the same place now. I really need to just grab him for about 3 hours, which he'll probably never do because his time is so valuable, and just sit with him and just hunt his mind for everything he knows. He is so interesting. I feel so blessed to have that relationship with him. But Burgess worked with them in the bringing in sort of a different role for more of a psychiatric medical type expertise that she brought to the group. So you have these FBI agents, particularly Douglas and McCrary and then Ressler, that are trying to evaluate crime based on behavior. And so they bring her in. And as I'm telling you, from the beginning of time in the Bureau, that is what the Bureau does. They bring in outside SMEs. I just saw pop up here that they would like to hear what McCrary said on the case. Greg was so kind to join Break the Case, to join us here and talk all about this case with us. He actually said he had about 30 to 45 minutes and he ended up staying with us for over 2 hours because there was a glitch that we had at the end where he couldn't hear me. And so we had to reboot and put in a new stream and start up. Please watch it. It's a two-parter. We're going to discuss it here. I'm going to highlight what he had to say. But please watch that. It is so worth. I had it highlighted for a while, but please watch what he has to say. I think it's so important. I just wish it wouldn't have had that glitch, but we're not sure whose end it was on. But nevertheless, we rebooted and everything worked. So anyway, Anne Burgess, her role with the FBI as sort of a contract employee that came in to lend her expertise as a nurse, and her psychiatric expertise specifically focused a lot on victimology. What is victimology? That is, again, how prone are you, if you will, I'm just going to put in layman's, to become a victim? What is the victimology of the situation? I talked about victimology very early on about Nancy Guthrie. Her vulnerability level, her victimology is, no, she's not going to be a victim. Living in this house for 50 years, extremely, extremely secluded, pitch black. You could not even see this house unless you knew it was there. And you meant to go here in the Sonora Desert, very isolated when it came to sort of lighting and being able to see outside of Tucson. Her risk was an all-time low, her risk of being a victim. She was an 84-year-old woman, which people don't want to victimize 84-year-old women because they could die. There was absolutely, her victimology was about, or her, I'll put it succinctly, her risk of being a victim was at the lowest of the low. To give you what the highest of the high is, it's somebody who, say, is a sex worker, who is a drug addict, who is homeless, who is having a psychological issue and is on the streets in some way. All of that, your risk of being victimized is huge, either for being robbed, for sexually assaulted, for being beaten. All of these crimes now, you now have a huge risk component. When I teach classes, and I'm teaching one on Sunday, actually to the gay community, which I'm excited to do a class for them. When you look at the victimology as an example of the gay community, it is high. Jewish community, it is high. That's just facts. And the first part of any class I do before we go hands-on is I talk about how can we reduce the chance of becoming a victim. So that's literally what we go through. We go through an entire recipe to make your chances for becoming a victim extremely low. And then we talk about, but what happens when all of a sudden you become a victim? You still have to learn to fight. So nevertheless, when we're talking about, and I want to go back to Anne and what she brought to the FBI, again, was her nursing background and her psychiatric expertise is what she brought. And again, this was in the 1970s. She specifically, I want to talk a little bit more about her background. She, interestingly, it's believed that she did have she had an actress play her in the Netflix Mindhunter. I wanted to get the name of that role or that character because I found that interesting. Wendy Carr. So she didn't consult on the show at all of Mindhunter. That's not what she did. She's not, you know, she wasn't part of the show, but Dr. Wendy Carr in that show was based on her character. Let's see further. She's written a lot of books. She definitely has a lot of knowledge. So she is similar in a way to Dr. Gary Brocato, who we're going to talk about later, because they are both industries. I'm going to call it industry scholars. So they're profilers that work more from an industry scholastic, but certainly Anne had more hands-on experience because she worked actually with Wrestler McCrary and with John Douglas. So if you look at her, that's kind of her background. It's kind of her background, okay? I want to talk about what she had to say, regarding this case. So I'm going to run through it. Number one, she believes that there's more than one perpetrator. So she's in love with, or not in love. She believes there's more than one perpetrator in this crime. She believes it was targeted. She believes that money would have been involved likely and not sex. She says sex is out, that this wasn't a sex crime. She believes there was prior planning. She believes there was familiarity with the victim. She believes, and this is interesting, that likely the person will not reoffend because it's so focused, it was so focused and targeted on Nancy Guthrie. So she believes that this was a one-off. In other words, this was somebody who wanted to get Nancy Guthrie and that nobody else is really at stake of getting hit, most likely. That's what she says. She says she believes it was based on a grudge or other sort of retribution type situation, retaliation, she says. She believes Savannah is the key. In other words, that it's not necessarily about Nancy, but that it's about Savannah. Okay, that it's about Savannah. And just, okay, I want to continue. I want to do what Ann Burgess says, okay? And not have too many comments. And after I finish with what Ann has to say, I have a couple of comments to say from a factual standpoint. She believes there was prior planning. She believes the person had familiarity with Nancy. She believes it was about power. And this is interesting to me. The only one to say this, by the way. Well, wait a minute. I think the other person said something similar, but let me go on. She says that this motive beyond the retaliation piece is about power and control over her social circle. Let me restate that. Power and control over her social circle. I found that very interesting because that's what this case has done, right? Nancy Guthrie, her neighbors, her people she played Mahjong with, her family, her religious group. I mean, how true is that? Total power and control over those in her circle. That's what this has done because they're all concerned. They're out of control. They can't find her. No one can find Nancy. No one can help Nancy. Power and control. You know, it's interesting because when you think of people that, like a Bundy or others that commit these horrendous crimes, it's about power and control, right? Everybody thinks it's, well, to hurt them or sexual gratification. All that happens. They're hurt and the person's sexually gratified. But at the end of the day, the deepest emotion that is being satisfied is their urge for control and power. And that's what Ann Burgess is saying here, that if you really dig deep, that it's about control and power, not only over Nancy, that's already been done, but over her circle. And I just thought that was interesting how she termed that. She says that And I think this is from just not knowing all the facts, but that, you know, things would have been more turned up inside the house from our understanding. And again, that's source information, but it seems that there wasn't a lot of destruction done in the house, which I still believe is because there was not 41 minutes spent in that house. There was much less than that because I think he was on camera at 2:12 and then went in the house. So this is more in keeping with statistics regarding abductions and how quick they are in and how quick they are out. She says, so I'm sorry, to be clear, she doesn't say the house was turned upside down. Actually, that's somebody else. She says, but this is what she does say. She says something went wrong inside the house. And I think I'm sorry. I'm going to stick with her. I keep wanting to editorialize because I like a lot of what she has to say. She says something went wrong inside the house. Wrong meaning that the plan was awry, that the plan became awry. She says the purpose again, I mean, she was specific in, was to inflict pain on others, right? So to just kind of recap her thoughts, targeted, this was about money. This wasn't about sex. I'm sorry. This was about money. This was about a grudge. This was about a retaliation. This was to inflict pain. This was to practice power and control over her social circle, that something went wrong inside, she believes, that there's more than one perpetrator, and that Savannah was the key, and there was prior planning. So that is, in a nutshell, the generalities of what the facts are telling Ann Burgess. What facts support what Ann Burgess has to say? Well, we know there was blood on the stoop. That would show us that something likely went wrong there from a physical standpoint. When you look at what has happened, certainly power and control and to inflict pain on those that loved her and were in her circle, that's already happened. So that's where she's getting that from. No sexual assault or reason for this crime. We've all pretty much said that, and that is sort of corroborated if we believe the source information that the house wasn't very much disturbed. If there would have been this huge sexual event, there would be more DNA. You know, we wouldn't just be working with one rootless hair and possibly some other mixed DNA from touch DNA. So when you look at that, that makes a lot of sense. She doesn't think this was a sex-motivated crime. Prior planning, we know that now, right? Because of the 11th that's been pointed out, the night before that's been pointed out. I've seen the 24th be pointed out, but I have to tell you, I cannot find any corroboration of that. All I can find is about one neighbor mentioning, you know, one neighbor mentioning that. So again, if I can't find it, like, for instance, on the 11th, that has been corroborated from Pima County Sheriff. It's been corroborated from Savannah Guthrie and the whole Guthrie family, and it's been pointed out by witnesses. So I have a trifecta of belief that the 11th was critical. And then we also have the photo of Porch Guy, where Porch Guy is not in his proper outfit. He doesn't have his gun, he doesn't have his holster, and he doesn't have his backpack. And he has different shoes, I believe, and a different shirt. So all of that would lend itself to believe another day. And then also the lighting is different. And on the 11th, I pointed out this was I believe, a waning crescent, and it was a full moon on the 1st when she was abducted. All right, so this is what my point is. A lot of what Ann Burgess says is backed by facts known in the case. So that's always important when I see that there's facts known in the case that back up what a particular profiler says. Good morning, Jen. Has there been any history of prolific serial killers or unsolved homicides which stands out similarities to Tucson? Great, great question. And the answer is no. And in fact, I did a whole one whole day on could Porch Guy be a serial killer? And I may end up highlighting that one. I really liked that segment. Spent a lot of time pre-planning that segment. In other words, researching all the characteristics you look for that a serial killer would have and what they would do and their motivations and so forth. And then how statistically that lines up with what happened in the Nancy Guthrie case. So hopefully you might go back. I just did that about maybe 3 or 4 days ago. It's titled, Could Porch Guy Be a Serial Killer? I think I titled it something like that. I think on that one, we have Porch Guy's face as opposed to another face being on the thumbnail. Take a look at that, see what you think, and see if that helps at all with answering that question. Great question. And thank you so much. I appreciate that. Is that a dog in there? I can't see. That's how bad my glasses are. All right. Nevertheless, I want to move on from Ann Burgess, who had some intersection again with the Bureau, with working with the Behavioral Science Unit many years ago in the 70s, who has written books and who was considered part of that group of Greg McCrary, John Douglas, and Ressler, those prolific FBI agents really started looking at crime in a way it had not been looked at in terms of serial killers and mass killers. As to why, what's making them tick? Can we see patterns here? So she was definitely, although not an agent, was part of outside help that came in to kind of lend her expertise in terms of her educational background to those cases. I want to talk next. This is Dr. Gary Picotta. And I mentioned earlier, we became friends some years ago. He's been on the show, a friend of the show, has not been on recently, but I have talked to him many times. I've talked to him often, just talked to him a couple of days ago. When I say talked, communicated, we're big texters. And I want to go through what he had to say. Now, he was asked by TMZ to talk. And so he went on TMZ, and this is what he has to say. He says that this is a situation of practicing ownership over a victim, that Porch Guy does a good job of minimizing his chances of being caught because of when he went and so forth. In other words, Bricado called this a high risk. Oh gosh, I forgot to go through his bona fides. Let me quickly go through Gary's background. And by the way, I'm not calling him Gary out of disrespect for him being a PhD. I'm calling him that because he tells me to call him Gary. All right. His background. He went undergrad to Columbia, and then he got his PhD from the New School of Social Research in New York. Now, I hear it called the New School now, but it was the New School of Social Research. Guys, that's hard to say. The New School for Social Research. And I want to say, personally, I had never heard of that school. Just, you know, personally. But again, I was never looking for a school to go to get a PhD in psychology. And that's what his degree is in, to be clear. He has a PhD in clinical psychology from the New School for Social Research. I still don't know why I can't say that. It's like Sally sells seashells down by the seashore. He's trained at numerous New York institutions, the Creedmoor Psychiatric Center and the Zucker Hillside Hospital Center. He focuses in on attenuated psychosis syndrome, which essentially I think is early psychosis, you know, how people become psychotic early. He has a big background in studying serial, mass, and spree killers. In fact, he told me that he has looked at every single case of mass murder that has ever been committed here and abroad. So big background there. He has served as the assistant director of COPE for about 7 years, not since 2021. He oversaw research on early psychosis and potential violence risk. So in a nutshell, his expertise and his area of study, from my understanding, both from what I've read and then from conversations with him, is a lot sort of trying to identify early on individuals who would be prone, to committing crime, like psychosis as a young person. That's sort of his area. That mass murder, serial murder, and like I said, to me, the really interesting part is the sort of the early on. He's been a visiting scholar at Boston College in researching forensic topics like homicide and mutilation. It's interesting because I've had a lot of interesting communication with him regarding this and about how from understanding from doing the job, and he understands from studying, right, how things have happened, that mutilation, and I pointed this out on the Celeste Rivas case, it's because it's necessary for the most part. Believe me, I'm not saying that with everybody. I mean, Bundy, he was something else and took enjoyment from things that are nightmares. But most of the time, it's because you mutilate somebody because you want to get a ring off their finger. You want to take their finger that has the tattoo of your name. You need to get them in the frunk. You need to get them in a barrel. You need to get them in a confined space. You want to mutilate them, in other words, dismember, so you can scatter them. So it's more difficult when you have a body part here, a body part there, a body part someplace else. So typically, that's why people mutilate. It's not because of this enjoyment you get. And that's not to say some people don't get enjoyment, because I really believe they do. But typically, it's because it's a pragmatic reason. So anyway, he studied that. He operates within the Clarity Therapy Clinic in New York City. That's where to find him now, is my understanding. You know, he still works with helping individuals. Okay. So that, I just wanted to give you a flavor that while he doesn't have a law enforcement background, he was never an agent, he never worked the cases, he studied the cases that occurred. That's what he did. And that's what his expertise is in. So he went, or TMZ contacted him, and he went on TMZ, and I want to give you what he has to say. Again, ownership over the victim, minimized chances of getting caught. He had a high reward, meaning what he wanted to do was going to be accomplished, compared to the low risk based on what he did. He believes firmly that there is, he called it a group of people involved, but he says at least two. A group of people, but at least two. And that there's two different levels operating here. Sort of the dummy or the puppet and the puppeteer. How he describes it, though, I'm using puppet and puppeteer. Did not use that. I want to use his words, waiter and chef. So he says there's a waiter in this case and a chef in this case. And he believes, obviously, that the waiter in this case is Porch Guy. He says, this is the waiter. So he says that there is somebody behind the curtain. He calls it the curtain, which is the chef. the chef's behind the curtain of what happened. And he describes Porch Guy as a hired goon. He says he's psychopathic in character, that he's the waiter, not intelligent, not scheming, but basically he's hired to do, and Gary calls it a gig. He says he's called a gig. It's a gig. It's a job. That's what he says about Porch Guy. It's just a job. He's going out there to do it. He says that likely he did it for financial reasons. He was hired. He says this crime wasn't about sex or robbery, but that's what he believes. He really, really, I want to stay on for a minute, even though it was out of order how he said this. I want to stay on what he says about Porch Guy. He calls him cool, experienced, callous, detached, local knowledge, knowledge of the victim, ego issues. He's saying that this person, if you know him outside of Porch Guy, that he would be quick to temper, that he is a narcissist, that he's a grudge holder, that he is likely intersected with the drug world. Things like sex workers or drugs, I should say underworld. That's what he expects, that when they find Porch Guy, that is going to be what he's all about. Cool, experienced, in other words, he means having committed other crimes. Callous, detached, local to the community, knowledgeable about the victim, huge ego, extreme anger issues, narcissist, big temper, grudge holder, and likely was around the underworld, such as in the drug or sex worker community. And I really hope that you're doing what I'm doing, is really comparing and contrasting what Ann Burgess says and what Gary Brocato says, because in a lot of ways, they're very different. A lot of ways, they're very, very different. But there are certain threads that are interwoven. And I think the reason that they're different in so many ways is because they come from very different backgrounds. They really come from a different age. You know, if you look, Gary Brocato is young compared to Ann Burgess. And she did the lion's share of her work, you know, 70s, 80s, early on in the early development of all of this. And Gary is more recent, where he likes to analyze cases going on now and things like that. So anyway, I just found the juxtaposition, if you will, between the two profiles or psychological profiles to be quite astounding in a sense. Because although, like I said, there are some interwoven threads, I thought their overall psychological profile was just so much different. Talked about the person behind the camera, he said, or behind the curtain. He says that person's a schemer. They live a double life. They're very intelligent. They're very cunning. They can seem caring, but they're really not. And they, you know, were obviously focused on hurting Nancy. So these are very, very different profiles. But when I say that, Gary does offer up that this could be an abduction gone bad. He does offer that up sort of, you know, as a side. But what he spends the majority of his time on, and you can tell, to at least in my opinion, what he thinks happened, he describes it in detail. He says, from studying these, that this is what you call an elimination murder. Now, an elimination murder, and this is the, I'll give you the example he gives, is for those of you who know Susan Smith, right? Susan Smith she wanted to have a life with another guy. So romantically, he wasn't into the fact that she had two small children. So what she did was she drove her car with them strapped in it and drowned them in a little lakish air, pondish area. And so she does that. And then she comes on and cries and says, oh, it was a stranger that did it. So Dr. Picado is saying that this could be, he thinks it could be an elimination murder, where actually the whole reason behind the murder was not what the murder would seem. He even goes on to say that this could be, that she could have been killed. That the, okay, so let me be clear. He says the motive wasn't abduction. I mean, this is his main theory. He says there's two, he always caveats it, or it could be an abduction gone bad. But what he spends all his time discussing is an elimination murder, and that in fact, she could have been killed someplace else. That was probably the biggest thing that he said that is off what anybody has said. Killed someplace else, and then whoever did this staged the murder, including the blood drops, the doors being open. He talks all about that, okay? And that the two ransom notes that we know about, he says that's just part of it. That's part of making it look like it's an abduction gone wrong. That it's basically, he says that this is caveating again. He does mention at least once. He caveats it with, this could be just be a kidnapping gone bad, the Occam's razor that I always talk about. But that this is an elimination murder, killed someplace else, staged to look like an abduction. It's not an abduction. The ransom notes are fake. The blood is fake. The doors being opened fake. And that the victim was never there. That's what he says. And he believes that everyone involved is from Tucson. He believes, again, that this was made to look like an abduction, but it's not. He says these murders are done for one of two reasons. Typically, one is very emotional, like you loathe them. So this would be somebody that actually hated Nancy Guthrie. Someone is in the, these are the four reasons that these types of murders are done. Someone's in the way, like with the Susan Smith that he talked about, that those kids were in the way of her having this romantic affair. They witnessed something that's embarrassing or otherwise would be bad. Or, and then I starred this because this was the last one he said. He took a lot of time with it. Someone that is a burden to them and they are tired of being taken care of. He thinks whoever did this knew the victim. He thinks it was, again, financial, likely, not sex or robbery. I think that pretty much sums it up. So again, he touches on, this could just be an abduction gone wrong, but he talks about the elimination murder. Murdered someplace else, wasn't even in the house, everything is staged. Blood on the front porch, that's all staged, blah, blah, blah. That all of that is staged. Again, I never ever discuss what Gary, Dr. Picado, and I talk about personally. and he never discusses what I talk about him personally. So anything I am saying right now is strictly from his TMZ. He did an interview with TMZ to answer Mike's question. So go on TMZ, you'll find it. These are my copious notes. And essentially that's what he thinks. It's, you know, I'm an Occam's razor girl. I've said that from the beginning. That has always, whether it's been in my analysis of these cases, served me very well. And then certainly as an FBI agent, you have to keep your mind open to any possibility. And could this be a possibility? It's a possibility. It's not an Occam's razor. This is the opposite of Occam's razor. This is the very involved, multiple aspects to it. You know, this is opposite of Occam's razor. Occam's razor is person goes in, means to abduct her, she dies, and the person's motive is primarily, in my opinion, in this case, retaliation against the family, money. It all goes wrong. You continue to hurt the family through these two letters that are followed up with. And I think they have a huge, and I've said this, social media presence to help spin that either nothing happened or that the family's involved. I think they're very much involved on social media. And I hope law enforcement is looking at who could be their personas on social media, spinning things away from them. But I wanted to go over what Dr. Bricotta thinks because, you know, I like Gary a lot. And I think he offers a very unique perspective. And, you know, his case is solved. It'll be interesting to see, was he right? Was he wrong? Was she murdered someplace else? Was the goal murder? Which is what he's saying. It's an elimination murder. And then everything at that house was staged. Now, let's talk about, just like we did with Anne, what are the facts that support his premise and what are the facts that don't support it? I think the facts that don't support this premise are, if we believe the sheriff specifically said that from the beginning, their understanding of the motive has never changed. In other words, that it was a kidnapping for ransom. Okay, that's what he says. We see the actions of the family. We see the actions of the FBI. We see four emotional and one not necessarily emotional pleading from the family to the abductors. So clearly the FBI would not stage anything like that if they didn't believe it was that. Now, I want to make it clear again that Gary Bricotta specifically says it could be that, just what we just talked about, the Occam's razor side. But he offers this other opinion that I think is very unique to him. And it'll be interesting to see if he's right here. There are certain things that don't make a lot of sense that would explain from his vantage point. For instance, why open two doors? Was that part of being staged? A lot of people have had issue with the blood. Why, even if there was, and you know, Mac and I have talked about it from the beginning, that only one person, that the goal of Porch Guy was to take her through that front door and gone. I've always said, from my point of view, she never walked one step. He grabbed her, gagged her, put a hood over her head, and threw her over his shoulder and took her out. That's what I've always thought. And so that leads only one person with footsteps on the porch. And we could see by the blood, there's nothing squashing in and out through the blood. This was something Mac and I discussed months ago. And that it doesn't make any sense that there was a whole tribe of people taking her out, because there's just nothing that shows that. So to Dr. Gary Bricotta's point, the blood there lends itself to believe that nobody traipsed through it. And so one might ask, how could even Porch Guy have avoided traipsing through the mud or through the blood, right? How could he have even avoided that? If she was bleeding at the time he carries her off, how could he avoid not smudging it? Okay. So I think that the back doors being open and that could support his position. That, in other words, the whole thing was staged. But this is an elaborate Cecil B. DeMille, I'll call it. This is an elaborate The Godfather type production. If that were if he ends up being right, and that's the case, this is elaborate, everyone. This really, really is. Because you're talking about a guy that you get to go up on that porch to snatch the camera, to mess with the weeds, to, you know, take her, or no, not take her, sorry, she's dead, but to fake going in, to be seen on that camera at 2:12. Remember? So you're faking a lot. So we'll see if that works out. But, you know, you heard it on TMZ first. If he ends up being right about this, it's a unique perspective. And again, he's a scholar who has studied murder and psychosis. He's a psychologist, PhD in psychology. And so that's his background, and he lends this perspective. Finally, I want to go on to my mentor, friend, Greg McCrary. Okay. Oh, gosh, I want to respond to this really quick before we go on. For anyone saying that any high statistic of elderly abductions is the family, they are absolutely wrong. So please don't get caught up in that. When it comes to murders of individuals being committed by the family, there's a graduated scale. And basically for younger people, yes. I mean, it's statistically more problematic that if you are murdered in your house as a child, a young person, it's statistically, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, 10, somebody who isn't able to drive, you are statistically, it's more often a family member, a friend, somebody very close in your inner circle. When you are talking about abductions, it's also very high for kids because most abductions of children are parental abductions. Those are the ones that I have a lot of my background in. Parental abductions, parental kidnappings. So those stats are skewed that way. But when you are talking about a woman in their 80s, first of all, that is at the lowest of a low. It's below 1% of all people who are abducted. Again, the largest quantity are those individuals that are young and parental kidnapping cases. As far as stranger, which I wouldn't even call stranger, but another area of kidnappings that are more predominant are those that are in the cartel, narcotic, gang type related that are specifically over money or revenge, right? You ripped me off of my 2 kilos. You looked wrong at my girl. I heard you rub my girl's feet. I'm just kidding. That's from Pulp Fiction. That's why, you know, in that movie that they say they threw one of the gangsters off the roof or off the balcony because he gave somebody a foot massage. And then I love that movie, by the way. Call me gross. No, I love that movie because it shows how the reality of crime becomes normalized to criminals. And this is what I always saw. And so things that you wouldn't imagine people can joke about, they joke about. It becomes very normal. And it's kind of difficult to really understand that premise. But how I explain it is just think of all the things that are normal in your life. It's normal to drop your kids off. It's normal to bake dinner. It's normal to play mahjong. It's It's normal to sweep. It's all these things that are normal, right? That are your life. Well, when your life is a life of crime, of killing people, of handling drugs, of extorting people, of beating people up, of dealing with, you know, sex workers, that's where you get your, you know, satisfaction there of being high. When all that becomes normal, imagine your daily norm of what you joke around about and what is just, that is a norm that in Pulp Fiction they talk about. And so I'm just trying to point out that the different norms that are established and that people like Gary Picado, people like Ann Burgess, people like Greg McCrary, this is what they study and become familiar with. I want to go over Greg's background. I never do a good job going over Greg's background. Again, Greg McCrary, one of the first FBI profilers, along with Ressler and John Douglas. They were FBI agents. He's a retired profiler. He worked in the behavioral science unit. It didn't become the name behavioral analysis unit till much, much later. When I was first an agent, it was the behavioral science unit. It changed to the behavioral analysis unit. They're the same units, but now there's many more facets of the overarching unit. There's just, in my opinion, no one more of an expert than Greg. He keeps a pretty low profile, but what he has done after he retired from being an FBI agent, he became an expert witness. And he is literally, literally is in, he's doing it. Instead of just talking about it on air or on a podcast, he does the work. He's sitting in a courtroom explaining from a profiler's vantage point why this perpetrator did what they did or what their what his premise is on the case. That he did it for decades. He did it in the Bureau. And then for decades, he did it studying cases and then testifying about them. He still, you will see him on different news mediums. You'll still see him. Like I said, we are so blessed. He's been on our show three times, talked about three different cases. He extensively talked about Nancy Guthrie with us for over 2 hours, which was so nice of him to analyze the case, spend the time to look at it, and then come on and talk to us, because he gets about $600 an hour for his expert work. So very nice of him to come on. Again, like I said, I love having the doers on. He's a doer. He is called. He's been accepted by multiple courts as an expert in his field of profiling. So thanks so, so much of him. He was a consultant. He was a consultant, he and John Douglas, on the Netflix series Mindhunter, a paid consultant. He also had the behind-the-scenes role of Greg Smith. So basically, Greg Smith, who's in that Netflix series, is him. They even spell it with two G's at the end, for those of you who didn't know that. So if you've ever watched that, John Douglas is kind of the main role, and then Greg McCrary is Greg Smith. On that, that character is fashioned after him. And that's why Greg McCrary consulted him on that. Let's see. Anything. I mean, he consulted for the Silence of the Lambs. He was one of the people. And that's why, of course, you see that in this case, the Silence of the Lamb terminology was utilized by Nancy or Savannah Guthrie when they were pleading to the kidnappers, because they have found things like that to work in the past. Talk to her and you'll see. Those were the exact words used not only on Silence of the Lambs, who Greg consulted on, but also used in this case. That's his background. Now he's mostly retired from the expert work, but he just can't get out of it. He's so funny. He's like, Jen, I just can't get out of it. So his caseload is far down from what it was before. He says this. The offender had a close connection, not random. The offender had specific details, inner circle. He believes he had a delusional, one-sided relationship, likely. Goes into a lot of detail about that. In other words, that, and I actually did a show on this, how people can think they're in sort of a relationship with somebody that they're really not. This happens particularly with famous people where they have, you know, like the Hinckley case, you know, thought Jodie Foster, you know, they're in some sort of relationship, needs to get her attention and tries to kill Reagan and in their mind, by the way, he's out now, and that they need to, you know, that they have this relationship that they actually really don't have. And he talks about that, you know, so basically saying that the offender has the close connection. So that's what his, to me, what I took away from his main point. It doesn't mean Nancy had the close connection, but that the offender had the close connection and was delusional in this one-sided relationship, that it was very deliberate and planned. This wasn't something that he said, and we know that, well, okay, I'll go through the facts that support Greg later, that deliberate and planned. This wasn't somebody that said, oh my gosh, she just pissed me off. I'm going to go over there and abduct her or kill her and I'm going to take her. It's no. He's saying quite the opposite of that. Quite the opposite of that. Deliberate, planned. He describes the person as being a person who would be very rigid, very nervous, and over-controlled. Rigid, in other words, when he's not on camera, right? Like this guy looks like he's picking daisies. But that in his life, that he's rigid, nervous, over-controlled, so a lot of control. He said after this happened, there would be a huge life disruption for him. Yeah. And I should say, Ann Burgess said that too. They both said that they would be closely monitoring media. You know, how close are they getting to us, to me? How close are they getting to solving this? So they're monitoring everything everyone's saying. And we saw that with Brian Koberger, right? Because they were able to get a lot of that. I couldn't believe it. I have the screenshot from the exhibit, the government exhibit, of the shows he was watching. And one of them was the show I was on. It's right in the middle. You know, my opinion about the Koberger case, pretty eerie to think how closely they're watching and seeing what you all are saying, likely on not just our platform, but other platforms, on mainstream media, on social media, on TikTok, on other platforms. You got to imagine that how we are studying this case. Imagine if you're the one that did it, how you're going to be studying it. And we learned that. We learned how true that was with the Brian Koberger case. Again, different deal. I understand that's a mass murder that I would say was a fledgling serial killer. In this case, I believe this is an abductor. Greg McCrary says retribution, received or perceived or otherwise. In other words, it's his perceived retribution of a wrongdoing. He says, and this Amber just says this too, they both say this, and I know they did not collaborate on this because I talked to Greg well before Anne Burgess ever spoke on it, that Savannah is the key. Burgess says Savannah is the key, and Greg McCrary says Savannah was the key risk factor for her. In other words, completely low risk, other than you have a famous daughter worth $40 million. So very important there. He says, Greg McCrary says, that whoever did this had very specific details about Nancy in the house. This wasn't somebody who wasn't educated on the area, the property, and on Nancy. That pretty much sums up Greg, what Greg had to say. Again, if you look at Greg and Anne, their psychological profiles of this occurrence are almost lockstep, pretty much lockstep. Yep, very in keeping for the most part with one another. In fact, I don't really see any area that's different. If you look at Dr. Gary Brocato, his is very different profile. Very different profile. Except for Anne and Gary both say more than one perpetrator. I believe Greg said that too. I don't have that in my notes, but just remembering my interview of him, I believe he said that too. I hope that you all will go back and take a look at the interview of that we did on Break the Case. It's a two-parter only because we started and we got probably 40 minutes into it, something like that. And then he couldn't hear my questions anymore. And so we literally had to reboot everything. I had to send him a new link to get onto the show. And it's really part two. And I think that was a really well listened to that he really gets more into it. But I hope you can watch both parts. But it is very interesting. The facts that support, again, what Gary and Anne have to say, I think are, you know, really scream out to everything. And that is his comfortableness around there. Again, they say it was pre-planned. We know that now because of the 11th. I believe personally, and I think they believe he wasn't in there an extended period of time, that it was a shorter period of time. I don't know how, if she was killed in another place, like Dr. Brocato says is a possibility. I don't know how her pacemaker could have connected. So again, you know, when you're looking at a profiler or somebody in that arena, and again, Gary Brocato isn't a profiler, both are, I mean, Anne Burgess and were profilers in practice, I guess you would say. And I guess you would say Gary's background is a psychologist. So I guess, I don't know. I guess I just mean not a profile working for law enforcement. So that's the distinction between Gary and Anne Burgess, profilers who worked for law enforcement practically in terms of a practical sense. Working these cases, and Gary is more of an academic who, from all his studies, makes opinions and offers a profile based on that, from that background. So let's see, home security offline at 12:51. I don't know where that comes from. Again, what I try to focus on for the most part, can I see it with my own eyes? Do we know it because law enforcement has told us? Is there a document that supports it? Has the FBI come out and said it? For instance, on the hair, they confirmed it's a hair. We tried to get it months ago. We've never changed our, you know, what we can do in terms of our ability to look at that hair. So they came out and made a statement, right? So I try to look at that as opposed to speculation. It's very important to me what different profilers have to say. And the reason it is because they have a lot of experience, practical experience in this area, and they've seen a lot. Dr. Picado studied it a lot. Ann Burgess studied it a lot. Gary lived it a lot. Lived it, interfacing, interviewing all of these bad guys. That's what he did. And Ann, too. Ann Burgess, to some degree, too, as an outside consultant. Guys, we'll stay on it. I always say, you know, I know a lot of people think this case is cold. You can see just from me in the background, it's there's so much to discuss on the case, so much to think about it, to think about based on what we know. It'll be very interesting to see how this turns out. I truly believe the Bureau will solve it. It's going to take extended amount of time. I'm still looking forward. Some of you saw that Elizabeth Smart's father was actually on regarding this case, sticking up for the family, the Guthrie family. Savannah is still being, all of them are being mercilessly blamed for their mom's abduction for various reasons. Anyway, he came on recently and said, listen, please don't blame the family. There's no facts that support that it's the family. I understand that a lot of people still think that, even people in my audience here and my audience on other platforms. And I really do respect everyone's opinions and what they have to say. I always just ask, hey, can you show me what's making you think that? I've even thought about having a show and just inviting those people in and saying, can you please show me why you believe something? And let's go through it. Let's see what facts support that. You know, that's another reason I always love having Mac on, because Mac is a fact-based person. And we don't see this case completely the same. Mac and I don't. We see it a little bit different. She's convinced it's just a one perpetrator. I'm not convinced of that, primarily because I think I see an HT sticking out. If it turns out to be a scanner and one person, then, you know, I stand by that. I would say a new set of facts have come in. It's tough, you know, when you are an expert witness, you get to see everything. There's nothing kept from you. You get to see the entirety of discovery, all the pictures. You get to hear all the interviews, see all the material, and you can make a really, really good assessment. When you are in the unfortunate circumstance of only seeing some, in fact, I would say 1% of all the evidence that exists in this case, becomes a little tougher to be able to make our assertions on what we think happened. I want to say thank you, Mary Ann Rosso, 1737. Thank you for joining our channel. It means a lot. I always say the biggest accolade, I think, is when members join your channel, because it shows their support of you. And something that I'm giving back to show support is going to be a going to put together a little basket, if you will, won't be in a basket, but a little grouping of different FBI memorabilia that I'm going to send out to the person who wins the drawing on August 16th. And that's only if the case isn't solved before then. If there's an arrest before then, that's when I'll send it out. But it's really just to give back something very unique that nobody else could give, because these are actually going to be from my personal coins and things that I have, just to say thank you. And to, by the way, to all the mods and to all of you all who come on every morning with us, you know, I really, really appreciate each of you listening in, and I enjoy reading your comments. I thank each of you, and I hope you have time to, if you didn't get the whole show, to go back and really look at what each of these three, Gary Brocato, PhD in psychology, Ann Burgess, who worked with the FBI and was a nurse and provides a different perspective there, and then Greg McCrary, one of the original FBI profilers, in Mindhunter. He's Greg Smith in that show, fashioned after his character, and that you really take a look at what they had to say. They've been talking somewhat. Greg has only talked on our show about Nancy. Might have him back on later if he'll do it. He was on for almost 2 hours, so I hate to even impose on his time. But go back and take a look at that one. I may feature it just so you guys can easily find it. And again, I thank each of you for being here with us. Until next time, may justice be served for Nancy Guthrie and for all the missing.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.